Well, this last week, BJ and I got to go to Monroe, Washington, where they had a preacher's workshop. Was there about 14, 15 preachers there? And that was very encouraging to be meet with people and talk about some of the struggles we have and the joys of preaching and some of the challenges we face. And I was asked to speak about the church and the culture in which we live in. And so I wanted to share some of that information with you tonight. And BJ said it'd be great. And I had an hour and a half to do it when I was in Monroe. So I figured if I start right now, an hour and a half, that's 10 till what? So Julie says she could stay awake for the whole time. So we'll go for, 30 minutes. We're going to try to cut it down to that. But if I were to have a show of hands, how many of you think that the gospel could really be effective and flourish in the state of Oregon right now? Really? How many think it couldn't?
It's not.
Wow, just a few. It's not, is it?
That's right.
We're one of the most unchurched states in the whole union, along with Washington. And it's not just coincidence, it's one of the most liberal states. Washington and Oregon share together what? Marijuana is legalized, assisted suicide, of course, same-sex marriage, and a lot of other host of liberal agendas. And so I'll be honest, when I was preparing for this material, I thought I was going to go this one direction, that we all ought to move to Africa where they're willing to listen to the gospel, because there's no hope left here. But you'd be surprised where I took a left turn, and it was the evidence in the scripture that took that left turn for me. And that's what I want you to see this evening, as we talk about the challenges before us when it comes to getting technology straight. Okay, we just had a technology meeting, and it was very encouraging. Here we go. I'm sorry? There we go. Does that work? All right. So when we talk about the culture of the church, I want to go to Africa, first of all. And I know that, you know, I've been going there. And my first trip was to Ghana with Brian Sutt. And we went to this village of Bobi. And it was quite a trip because it was an hour and a half out into the jungle over dirt roads. And when you got there, you had to go in front of the village chief to get permission to preach. And talk about a strange culture, right? Now, that's the village chief, and he didn't speak the whole time. He spoke to his advisors there, and he would talk to them. But does he look kind of stern? And it's intimidating because you have all these pictures from movies about chiefs and headhunters and cooking white men in a pot. And I know that's racist and all that because that's not what happens. But it's intimidating. Can I say that? All right. And this guy's smiling like, sure, you guys want to teach in our village. Well, Bob Buchanan is so good at expressing why we're there, that we're asking for permission to preach in your community. And if you let us do so, you're going to have better citizens. You're going to have better husbands and better wives and better marriages and better children. And he just sold the advantages and benefits of being Christian, which are all true. And of course, they love having us come because they know that is all the case. So we went over to a school building. And can you imagine in America, thus letting us go into a junior high or a middle elementary school and teaching the kids about the gospel? But Bob got that chance, and I got to witness him do it on several occasions. And then after that, you know, we were speaking to the adults in a room, about 75 adults, and the kids were just looking through the window. Yes, partially because we're a novelty, you know, white men from America out in the bush. Some of them never seen a white man in their lives. But they were glued to everything we said. They sat on these hard benches all day long. Some of them walked an hour and a half, we drove an hour and a half. They walked that distance to get there. Stayed all day long to hear the message. And then during the course of the afternoon, you got the feeling that not many of them had Bibles. So we had them raise their hand. How many of you had Bibles? Out of 75 or so there, you know how many raised their hand? Five people had their Bible, had a Bible, owned one. Now in America, everyone has Bibles, don't they? A lot of people have multiple Bibles. They never read them, yet they stayed all day long to hear the Bible being taught. Now, afterwards, we had this is interesting, too. The kids come to school. Do you know what that is in their hand? It's a machete. Could you bring a machete to school today? No, you would be suspended permanently from the rest of the year, right? But he's not actually has two of them, because during recess and lunchtime, they have the kids go out and mow the field, because they don't have lawnmowers, they have children and machetes. And they know how to handle those things, so you don't mess with the kids either. And afterwards, we blessed them with these things that you guys all packaged, you know, just little things of soap and a sample size of toothpaste. They love it. It's supposed to be for the kids, but notice who's in the picture. It's all the mothers. And it was an orderly line, but after a while, it got out of hand. It was a mob scene, and we had to say, okay, that's it. We're done. And then they blessed us with the only thing they had, and that was a basket full of plantain, I think some papaya, and then three live chickens. Now, what are you going to do with three live chickens? You say thank you, you put them in the trunk, and it's an hour and a half over bumpy roads back. And when you get back, you open the trunk, block. You know, they're just barely alive. Now, I don't know what happened to those chickens. I assumed we ate them for dinner, you know, that night or the next night. Now, they would do this everywhere we went, just eager to hear the gospel. Travel miles, cross borders and muddy swamps, literally, just to hear the gospel. Let's turn to America. United States of America, a Christian nation. This was up in Washington, so that's why I shared it with them. This lady in Spokane is being sued because there is a couple, same-sex marriage, that wanted her to do flowers for their wedding, and she's helped them with many other things. So she was friendly to them, and they had a good relationship. But when it came to the wedding, she said, my conscience can't allow me to do it. She liked the people, but said, no, I can't. And so now she's being sued. And, of course, you can see the title here, my relationship with God trumps my connection to anyone on earth, and now I'm getting sued. And then we saw here this last month, our government saying that you had to allow people that identify as another gender than they were born to enter bathrooms of the same sex. So if you are born with male biological parts, but you identify as a female, you're supposed to be allowed to go into a female locker room. And here it's a paper headline. Girls must overcome discomfort of seeing male genitalia. Now, where are we in America where now that's being promoted? Now, the other thing that happened this last month was this gorilla. Remember that child climbed through the fence, was down in the gorilla pen, and he drug him around, and they were fearful for his life. And so they shot the gorilla. Correct? Do you remember all the uproar over that poor gorilla being shot? Nothing was said about the kids that they saved his life. And they attacked the mother. And so here it was, boycott the zoo, protect the animals, keep brats out of the habitats. And they wanted to prosecute the mother because they were so sad about the death. Well, then don't they call it a murder? Oh, not on this one. But they called that ape being murdered. But what about the life of the child? Now, meanwhile, the same week in New York, this gentleman was arrested, was going to be charged with manslaughter because his wife was in the apartment complex. A guy let himself in, got through security, waited till someone buzzed the door, and he went in too. He went and knocked on all the apartments until someone opened the door. It was his wife. And when he got in there, he started to attack her, threw a chair and hit her, and was going to rape her. He's already been convicted of assault like this. It was in jail. She was fearful for his life. Her husband comes home and beats him with a tire iron. He ends up dying. Now, it's his wife or him, you know, the suspect. Well, they're charging him with manslaughter for saving his wife. And they want to charge a mother for the murder of a gorilla. Are things upside down? So you get to the point, is there any hope for America in spreading the gospel when you have this type of mentality? Of course, I was convinced, absolutely not. That's my question. Can we effectively preach the gospel in today's society? And the second question is, similar to it, is our current culture make it impossible? Because as Hewlin rightly observed, we don't see large success with the gospel, do we? And people coming to the Lord. So why is that? So let's look at the culture of America, and then let's look at the gospel. When we consider the culture, we first got to define the word. And I thought this was interesting, and I shared it there in Monroe, that it was the word of the year for the Merriam-Webster Dictionary. Did you know they have words of the year? I didn't know that. Now, what would qualify culture for being the word of the year? Do you know? It's the word which is looked up the most frequently online for its definition. So that means in America, the number one word that people are seeking the definition for was culture. Because what is in our news media and in our conversation all the time? Culture wars. You know, the culture of this, the culture of life, the culture of death, culture, you know, of responsibility. And culture is declining and the change and the shift in culture. Well, people want to know, what does culture mean? Now, culture is not something you brew in a biology lab. You know, a culture of tissue? That's not a culture that we're talking about, right? Culture is not going to the museum or to an opera. That's high culture, right? What are we talking about when we say culture? Culture is difficult to be defined, but here's a good definition. It's the way of life of particular people. Okay, it's a way of life. And I'm going to give you this one real quickly because I think it's more succinct about it. It's the sum totals of way of living by a group of human beings, and it's given to them from the previous generation. So that's what culture it is. It's the way you and I live based on the values that we've been taught by society at large. Society is our family, our schools, our churches, the news, the media, entertainment. Does that affect our values? Just TVs and music and literature? When you put all those things together, they are what influence our values and dictate our behavior. So as the culture changes, values change, and as values change, behavior changes. And that's why we're living in a society that has more sympathy for a gorilla than for a child, and for the sexual attacker than the victim. And we could go on and give a zillion more examples, couldn't we? So when you look at it, why is that? Because increasingly, United States specifically, all of Western civilization for that matter, is becoming more and more secular. Now, secularism is the removal of God from society. And it started removing God from the public square, from public discourse. It has no place, is the idea, in politics, in school, in the public arena. You could have your faith, but we don't introduce it into the public discussion. And as you remove God from society, what replaces that vacuum? Well, that's secularism, no God or anti-God. And everybody becomes a God unto themselves. Because if you don't have a God, a supreme authority that lives above this world, dictating what morality is, who gets to decide what is right and wrong? Either government, the local community, or the local group of people, or the family, or the individual. And now that's why the autonomous person gets to decide what he thinks or believes is right. And so who are you to say someone else is wrong? Because there is no God, everyone else can decide for themselves. And that leads to relativism, where everything's relative, and there are no absolutes. And then that leads to pluralism, and that is what we're talking about, where everyone has a right to have their own values and their own beliefs. This gender identification thing, have you ever heard of that before? It's where you have the right as an individual to identify with any gender other than that you were born with, because who are your parents to assign a gender to you? You say, well, that's ridiculous. You were born a male. No, the biological male, but I feel like a female. So if I want to identify as a female, you have to let me. Or if I want to identify as gender neutral, I'm neither male nor female. State of Oregon, a judge ruled for the first time in our nation this last week that an individual was allowed to identify as gender neutral. Because he was born a male, but he really didn't identify as a female, but not really a male, so he's gender neutral, or they call it gender queer. And Facebook, if you do their profile and you say, you know, where are you from, your email and all that, I don't think you put email anymore, your gender, 54 different classifications for gender. 54! We're binary kind of people, male and female. 54? Well, you can look at them. And it's this attitude, who are you to say what is right and wrong? Everyone gets to do what they want, and we have to accept it, or at least tolerate it. That's pluralism. Every faith is equally valid. Every value is equally valid. Every political opinion is equally valid, as long as you hold it to yourself. Now, without spending a lot of time, let's just go to some quotes. Here is Alan Bloom writes, and he says, every professor knows that every student that comes to university as an incoming freshman, they have one concept, and that is truth is relative. That means most of the children, because I think there are some exceptions to this, when they go to college, they do not believe in absolutes. Is stealing wrong? Depends. Was murder wrong? And it depends, too, on the scenario. There are no absolutes. And you look at me and you go, that's crazy. Well, that's the culture in which we live in. Now, what chance does the gospel have in a culture that is so pluralistic and where there are no absolutes when Jesus comes and says, I am the truth, the way, and the life. No man can come to the Father but through me. What chance do you have talking to this kind of person that about unless you believe that Jesus is, you will die in your sins. That's pretty absolute, isn't it? Be not deceived. No immoral person, no homosexual, no adulterer, no adulterer, and the list goes on, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Is there any chance for you to identify as one of those things and still make it to heaven? So they reject the gospel. What chance does the gospel have? None. In our society, you might think that, but let's don't get ahead of ourselves. Let's go on, though. Here, this fellow's dead. He's a professor at Oregon State University. He was. And he said, when I ask my students to write an essay on their impression of Christianity, look at the words that keep coming up. Five adjectives. They're literalistic, anti-intellectual. Did you know that's you? You're anti-intellectual. In other words, you don't know how to think. You're not very well read. You're self-righteous. You're judgmental, and you're bigoted. Students, that's their impression of Christianity. So when you talk to a young person, you say, I would like to talk to you about Christ. What are they thinking? Oh, here we go, a bigot, a guy that is self-righteous and just wants to judge me, and they can't think for themselves. The hypocrite. What chance are you going to have with that kind of mindset? Well, we're not done. David Kinnaman, he's of the Barna Group that does a lot of these surveys, especially in the religious realm. When they asked non-Christians, 16 to 29, what is your perception of Christianity, here's how they responded. Well, they're anti-homosexual. Well, that's pretty much right. Not the person, but the lifestyle, right? Judgmental, hypocritical, old-fashioned, too involved in politics. That's true of much of the denominational world. Out of touch with reality, insensitive to others, and they've been listening to my preaching. Boring. Now, if that's people's attitude, what chance again are you going to have sharing the gospel with them? It's going to be a pretty tough road to hoe, isn't it? Well, here's what Jesus says. And the question that I struggle with sometimes, do we need to remove ourselves from this world and disengage from the culture, or do we need to do the opposite, engage? And sometimes you would think, If that's the way they're going to live around here in their attitude, let's just make a commune somewhere in the valley, right? And just live by ourselves, and we'll take care of each other, and, you know, fooey on the rest. Well, that doesn't work. But you think, well, yeah, Jesus said, you're not of this world. I chose you out of the world because the world hates you. Paul said, come out from their midst and be separate, right? And Jesus said, John said, don't love the world, nor the things in the world. Because if you love the world, the love of the Father is not in you. Of course, James says, if you're a friend of the world, you're an enemy of God. So now do you want to start that little commune? But then here's the other side of it. Jesus said, you're the salt of the earth. He said, you're the light of the world. And you put a light under a bushel or basket. No, what do you do with the light? You put it on a stand and shine so everybody can see it. Who's everybody in this context? It's the world. So can you disengage and remove yourself from the world and be a light? It's not possible. So he says, let your light shine in such a way that they can see your good works, and in turn glorify God and your Father in heaven. And that's why Jesus said, I don't ask you to take them out of the world, but just keep them safe from the evil one. Paul said, conduct yourself with wisdom toward outsiders so you might know how to respond, but make the most of opportunity. Now, here's something that's very interesting. Every time you engage someone, it's an opportunity. Opportunity for what? The gospel, Jesus Christ. And we're going to build on that thought in just a second. So here's our solution. Because we want to look at solution, not problems. Because we could spend the rest of the evening looking at the problems in the United States and the culture in which we live in. And that's not going to help at all, is it? We're just going to become a bunch of whiny people and they go, well, poor us, we never can do anything anymore. But is that the case? And here's where my thinking got challenged by the Bible and what happened in the New Testament. And we have to have a broader perspective and look at really what is going on and compare it to other generations. You look back in Genesis 6, did they have a problem with morality then? Their thoughts of their heart were on evil continually. When Israel was called out of Egypt and they became God's chosen nation and they're settled in this land flowing with milk and honey, did they have a problem with lordship? We find in Judges, there was no king. And everybody did what was right in their own eye. That's secularism, isn't it? And it's pluralism. You get to do what you want, and I get to do what I want. Of course, God judged them for it. And then, of course, we see in Luke chapter 17, just as it happened in the days of Noah, where every man's doing evil in his own, you know, in his heart continually, Jesus says, it's going to be the same way in my day. So in the days that the apostles were commissioned to take the gospel to the whole world, he said it's just as bad as it was in the days of Noah. It was so bad then that God destroyed the world. Now I want you to grasp that. Has anything changed from the days of Noah to the days of Christ to right now? No, we're just repeating the same cycle. The culture was very similar. This is not the first time you've seen cultures like we do have in America today. And then let's review again what happened so quickly in this immoral, godless culture. 3,000 the first day. We see at the end of that chapter, the Lord was adding daily those who were being saved. We see in chapter 4, 5,000 were added. And then we see as we continue through the book of Acts, chapter 5, multitudes were added to the Lord, both men and women. And then in chapter 6 and verse 7, the disciples multiplied the number of them, even a great company of the priests, the spiritual leaders. And then in Acts chapter 21, they're talking about how many thousands were among the Jews who had believed. So they lived in a culture that is much like ours, that Jesus said it was like the days of Noah, and the gospel exploded. Did it not? And you go, well, how is that? How did that come about? Now, before we look at this chart, I just want you to think about the Roman Empire compared to ours. So on one hand, we have the Roman Empire, and that's the culture in which Christianity started. Then we have our American culture. Did they have a problem with immorality in the Roman culture? Homosexuality? From the emperors all the way down. The best love is the love of a young boy, is what they would teach, right? How about, did they have a problem with prosperity and covetousness, too much money? Wealth, they gave them all the freedom to do all these things that they shouldn't. Do we have the same thing? Do we have wealth? How about education? Were they a bunch of idiots or were they well-educated? And did they have a lot of technology in their day? Anne was watching how they built some of their temples and their buildings, and they could not duplicate their engineering for many hundreds of years later. They had advances in engineering and in sciences that marveled many, many generations. Now, do we have technology today? Yeah, you should have been in that room. The technology is amazing what we can do. See the parallel? Were people literate back then and educated like our kids in school today? In many ways, their culture mimics and mirrors ours today. I really can't see much differences at all. There was liberty for the individual person. They protected the rights of the individual. Yeah, they had taxes. We've got taxes. They were a polytheistic world. We're a theistic world. Believing in one God, they believed in many gods. So that was even a disadvantage. Let me ask this. Was the culture during the Roman Empire pro-Christianity or anti-Christianity?
Anti.
How do you know that? Where did the great persecution come from? First of all, the Jews, but who did they use to inflict it as well? The Romans. Who instituted a great persecution against Christians but Nero himself, blaming them, Christians, for the burning of Rome? It was illegal to be a Christian. That's why they worshiped in caves and hid themselves. Was there a bias against Christianity in the Roman Empire? And it's from the Jews and the Romans. And you say, well, wow, that's not any different. There's a bias against Christianity, at least perceived in our day. I would suggest it was worse back then. No one shed blood in America for Christ, as I know of it. You might throw up a rare example, but as a whole, do we suffer and shed blood for Christ in America? No. Not yet. But we don't. So let me suggest this. Just stop having this persecution complex as though woe is us, no one likes us, and we can't do any good for the kingdom. It's not as bad as it was then. It could get that way, but the point is Christianity flourished under that type of culture. So what do you think it could do today? But just that. So you ask them, well, then what's the difference? Why did it flourish then? And why is it not flourishing now? Why were thousands added then? And we see a trickle of people now. This is a complicated answer. There's many factors, but I'm going to just boil it down to the basics. Is that okay? Because I just think very simplistically in my mind, especially as a preacher, what can I do to be most effective? BJ and I talk about this, and I know a lot of you talk about it. So when it comes to cooking up a conversion, we've talked about this some, but I want to review it. When I mean cooking up a conversion, if you were going to make cookies, you have a bowl, what would you put in that bowl? Flour, chocolate, lots of chocolate chips, right? And some sugar. What else would you put in there? Eggs. What else? Butter. These are, someone ought to try this out and bring them. What? All right. And then you stir it up. Do you have cookies? No, you got dough. Now what do? You put them in the oven and you cook them. You eat the dough with ice cream, right? What does it take to cook up a conversion, a salvation, to make a disciple of Christ? Is that a fair question? What ingredients you got to put in the bowl and mix up so you get a Christian? You say, well, that's complicated. No, it's not. It's not hard at all. So write this down. First, it takes a good and honest heart. And you say, well, a lost person. No, there's lost people everywhere. But the parable of the sower, remember there was four type of hearts. Only one heart made it. And it's a good and honest and an open heart, a heart that's ready. And you add to that one thing and only one thing only. So in our bowl, we're putting a lost person that has a good and honest heart. And what do you add to that? One thing and one thing only. What is it? The gospel. Paul said, I'm not ashamed of the gospel. It is the power of God in salvation. You take a good and honest heart and you add the gospel. What will you get every last time? A conversion, salvation, a disciple. Do you understand what we're saying there? It never goes wrong. How about the Ethiopian eunuch? What was he doing when Philip was told to run up to his chariot? He's reading. Where had he just been? Worshiping in Jerusalem. He come all the way from Africa to do so. And so Philip says, do you understand what you're reading? He said, how can I unless someone guide me? Does he have a good heart? Obviously, because what did he preach to him? Jesus, the gospel. So we got a good heart, the gospel. Do we have a salvation yet? No, you got to put them in the oven. Look, there's water. What prevents me from being a Christian? You know, he said nothing. He got baptized and he's raised into the family of God. Right? Now, how about Paul? Did he have a good and honest heart when he's killing Christians? I have a yes. Do I have any no's? He's killing and murdering people, torturing them, trying to get them to blaspheme Christ. Good heart? 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 15, God considered me faithful. Because I was ignorant. I had no idea what I was doing. But he did things according to what he believed was right. All he had to do is learn the truth. He had his Damascus moment. He got to see Jesus. And you know what he asked right at that moment? What did he ask? Lord, what shall I do? Is that your good heart? And the Lord said, no, you go to Damascus. I'm not telling you. You go to Damascus and there it'll be told you what to do. Of course, Ananias comes to him, commanded him to be baptized, said, why tarriest thou? Rise, be baptized, wash away your sins. How about Felix? Good heart? Paul preached to him and what was his reaction? Well, first he was what? Scared, right? He hears the gospel because he's talking about righteous self-control and the judgment to come. He's scared. He goes, go away. Do I get Felix right or is it Agrippa? It's Felix, right? And then at some other time, I'll listen to you. When did that other time come? Didn't, as far as we know. I don't know if he had a good and honest heart, but it wasn't open to the gospel, was it? Maybe later, I don't know. Paul wasn't open for a long time, but at the right time, he was. He had a good heart. But if you take these two things every time, without exception, you get a conversion. Could that be wrong? So there's one part in here that we have to draw our attention to. These people are out there, I just don't know where. This is always there. We're trying to get this. Here's the thing we have to draw our attention to. What's that?
Jesus.
No. Jesus comes through here, right? It's bringing the two together. Here's the gospel, whether it's in earthen vessels or in a book. Who's the plus sign? I gave it away by asking who. Has there anyone ever been brought to Christ with outside the agency of a person sharing the gospel? Has that ever happened? Never. Even Paul said, nope, you go to Damascus and there it'll be told. Did Ananias want to go?
No.
He was scared for his own life. And Jesus said, go, because he's praying. And when someone's praying, God will do anything it takes to get someone there to bring him the gospel. Case in point, Cornelius, good and righteous, good and honest heart. What's he been praying for? Salvation. And the Lord sent angels, sent spiritual visions, baptized people in the Holy Spirit just to get Peter there so he could witness it, so he could do one thing. And what was that? Be the plus sign. Because he was not going to preach the gospel to Gentiles. But he said, now I've been convinced that we're not supposed to be a respecter of persons. And he looked at the six friends behind him and he said, do any of you want to refuse the water to these people? And they go, not me, not after what God has demonstrated. See, you and I are the plus sign. We are what makes the two come together. There has never been a salvation or a conversion without a plus sign. That's you and me. Now let's look at this chart, and I'm not trying to make anyone guilty. I'm just trying to contemplate myself. What is it going to take to get wild success for the gospel? And when you boil it down, it's just this simple formula. It's not a formula. It's just, so let's look at culture today. Is a good heart affected by culture today? Yeah, it is a real problem. Especially when we're taught there's no absolutes. But is that any different from Roman time? No. Let me ask this. Is the teacher or the plus sign affected by culture? Absolutely. That, I think, is the problem right there. We're supposed to be in the world, but not of the world. But if we get so distracted and caught up in the world, we're busy doing things we ought not to do or doing good things because they're available to us, and we don't get around to doing what we ought to do, the gospel will not be taught. You understand? Now, I'm just going to say this bluntly because I'm condemning myself when I do it. The reason the gospel is not growing like it should, the church, is because I'm not teaching like I ought to. It's as simple as that. We're not teaching the word like we ought to. Could there be any other reason? You say, well, maybe there aren't any good and honest hearts left. That's a possibility, right? That was the case in Sodom and Gomorrah, so God what? Destroyed those two cities. Now, I can't help but say, I don't think we're there yet. We're nowhere near what they were like. We're nowhere as bad as the Roman culture in many ways. And you honestly believe, you raise your hands, you thought it could be effective in Oregon. That means you must believe there's good and honest hearts left in this community. So the problem's not with the opportunities. The problem, is it with the gospel? Is it affected by culture? No. It's the same today as it was yesterday and it will be forever. It is the power of God and salvation. Where's the problem lie? And I'm not trying to make us feel bad. I just want to make us aware so we go, wow. I can do what I need to do, and let's see what happens. You understand? It lies within us, the solution, because that's where the problem is. How about impotent? In other words, it's no longer powerful. It's possible that people just don't have the will or desire anymore, but here is where it's really the problem. We're just not doing our job. Is it ever with the gospel that it becomes not powerful anymore? Never, never. How about available? That answered the question we already addressed. Maybe there's no good and honest hearts left. Do anybody believe that? No. It's possible, but I think they're left. That's why God is still has not come, because he desires that all men come to repentance and not perish. And when he comes the second time, there's no more opportunity, is there? So I believe as long as there's opportunity, there's good souls left, our hearts, he wants them to hear the gospel. Well, this is the question. Are we available? Are we available? And is the gospel always available? Is God always there to save someone? In all three of these questions, where is this the problem and where is the solution? Right here. Right here. And I have to confess, in the last year or so, I've been spending too much time dealing with non-important issues that were urgent. You understand? They were urgent, but they're not important. They're urgent, and they caught your attention. You have to deal with them, but they're not important. What's the only important thing that I really need to deal with? is sharing the gospel with others and helping the saved stay saved and equipping you so you can share with others as well. That's all that matters. Not counseling financial problems, not dealing with relationship issues. The biggest job that I have, and that's what I want to get back to. I used to be teaching lots of classes, and I haven't been. And shame on me. I mean that. Shame on me. But if I could reposture myself as a preacher here at South Salem, I'm going to teach classes. That's what I want to do to those that are lost. And I want to help you do the same. So I'm asking you to do one thing. If you got a brother or a sister or a coworker or a family member that's lost and you care enough about them, ask them for a study and I'll teach it. BJ will teach it. Dave will teach it. I know there's others. And let's start doing what we once did and see what happens. It's not to say anything bad about anyone. It's just like, let's go. It's exciting with what can happen. How many were baptized at your camp?
25.
Youth. At a Bible camp they just came from. 25 youth that didn't have a closed mind, didn't believe there were no absolutes, that had good hearts. You think there's 25 youth in the state of Oregon? Pray that God will give us the opportunity. And let's just see what happens. I think it's exciting, the possibilities, because at one time I thought I just need to move to Africa where people are willing to listen. No, the work can be done right here. It's interesting, I had this quote, I just want to share it with you and we'll close. More robust churches will result from the death of nominalism. And I read that quote in that concept more than once. I said, what is nominalism? So here's the definition. It comes from the Latin word meaning by name only. So that's a Christian that are Christians by name only. So when they're filling out a survey, what faith are you? Muslim, Eastern, Christian, what do they put? They check the box, Christian. So culturally, they identify themselves as Christians, but do they go to worship? No. Do they pray or read God's word regularly? No. Do they love their neighbors or do anything that God calls us to do? No. So when you look at them who name themselves as Christian to a person, compare them to a person that doesn't name himself as a Christian, is there any difference in their behavior? No. But yet everyone looks at them, that's a Christian, so therefore that's what Christianity's like. Do you understand? That's why they think we're a bunch of hypocrites and we're judgmental. And that's why he says, when you have no more of that, people naming themselves Christians just by name only, you're going to have strong, robust churches. And I think that's true. I had to look at myself. Am I a Christian just in name only? Well, God help me if I am, but I don't think I am. But how do I prove that not to be the case? By living such a way that I let my light shine. So when people see my good works, they what? They don't talk good about me. They talk good about my Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. So there's our lesson. Preach the word, he said. In season, out of season. Because there will come a time, he says, they won't want to put up with sound doctrine. That's our society, there's no doubt. But the solution is what? It's right there. What's the solution? Preach the word. He said, is it that simple? Yeah, it's that simple. I was in a Starbucks when I was going up to Washington last week to that workshop, and I was waiting for my coffee, and the barista was really slow, so I was getting impatient. How spoiled are we in America? And I watched this lady in the far table by the window, and she put her baby on the tabletop, and she looked down, and she reached down, and she picked up a wad of bills. I go, man, I should have been over there. And I thought it's interesting. Does everyone see money when it's laying on the floor, generally? Do we recognize money? Oh, yeah. I said, man, I haven't seen money on the floor a long time or on the street. The most I've ever found was a $20 bill. But when we see money, does anyone walk on by? Or does everyone go, oh, lucky day, $5? We have a tennis out is what I'm saying, because it's valuable to us. You know where I'm going. There's people all around us that are begging and hurting for a solution, for some type of peace, for some type of direction. They want absolutes. They want direction. They want a relationship with God. they might not say it because they're embarrassed too, because they're affected by this culture. They're keeping it within themselves. But if we keep our antennas out and we just listen and are aware, we'll find those people. They'll give us little cues, and we don't have to preach at them, but we'll just pick up on it and say, hey, here's one. I got a live one, someone that has a good heart, and they're ready and they're open, and then we'll share Christ with them. Lord willing, in the weeks ahead, not next week, but coming up, we'll talk about ways you can talk to people in our culture that's effective. Because the way we approach people has to change nowadays because of the culture and where we're living. And we'll talk more about that later. But I hope this lesson helps. We went long, but it wasn't an hour and a half, was it? So I just want you to leave with just that thought. Yes, we can. If you're with us and you realize that Jesus is the Christ and you need to commit your life to him, or just as importantly, you've been too enmeshed in the world and not enough Christ in your life, you can make changes right now. If we can help you, won't you come? We sing just the first verse of the song selected, please.